Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Today we're talking about irritable bowel syndrome with my special guest, Professor Jane Andrews, who is head of the Inflammatory Bowel Diseases Service at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. One of the hot topics in IBS right now is that a simple test called the fecal calprotectin test would make it much easier to confidently diagnose IBS. But it's not yet available on the MBS despite quite a long period in review, and it's making the test more expensive than it needs to be, and therefore inhibiting good diagnosis.
They've had it for consideration before them for some years, and they've not yet completed the process. Now, they say that the problem is with the way the sponsor has made the submission. But, you know, as a taxpayer, I would say that's not very efficient use of our regulatory and funding bodies, that if they don't like the way they've put it together, they should make it work, because they've agreed that they think it's something that they think they should be approving.
What is calprotectin?
So calprotectin is a protein which is found in the cytosol, so in the, you know, mushy kind of moist part of the cell that's not the nucleus,
yes,
of white blood cells. And white blood cells should not normally be in your stool.
No.
So white blood cells in the stool means that there is a leaky barrier, and how leaky it is will determine how high the calprotectin result is.
Right.
So if you've got just a bit of redness, then you might have a very slightly elevated calprotectin. But if your lining of your colon, let's say it's very ulcerated because you've got ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, or you've got, you know, kind of E. coli enteritis, it's going to be in the hundreds or in the thousands, because there's going to be, you know, blood in the stool. But, you know, where the test is very good, and you know, the best area for using the test is in people who've got non-specific chronic, like longer than 6 weeks, bowel habit disturbance with loose stools.
Yes.
And you're finding it, you know, kind of, or the patient is kind of going, oh, I'm worried. And the doctor's going, no, well, I don't think there's anything to worry about.
Yeah.
And you get a negative calpro. And if it's in the normal range, so less than 50 is on most tests, you can say, well, this is proof that all of your lining is lovely, and so we don't even need to look at it.
Great. And is it then a natural progression from that to saying you've got irritable bowel syndrome?
Absolutely. Well, it's not a natural progression from that. It's just that it confirms what you're already thinking and what we should already be saying to the patient. So if someone comes along to see me and they've got symptoms that have been going on for, you know, 6 to 12 to 18 months that are consistent with IBS, and nothing else has happened, so they haven't lost a lot of weight, they haven't become anemic, they look fine, they're otherwise well, the first thing I say to them is, I think you've got IBS.
Yes.
And I think that because you've got these symptoms, they're non-progressive, they've been going on for a while, and you're otherwise well. And they look at you and you kind of go, well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you had, you know, colitis, you would have got worse.
Yeah.
If you had, you know, cancer, you wouldn't be looking so healthy, and, you know, things would have progressed, we'd be seeing blood by now. So you make the prediction that you've got IBS, and then you say, and to confirm that, I'm just going to run a couple of simple tests to make sure that we're not missing something. And fecal calpro is something that's really helpful in that regard, because you explain what the test is, and I find that it's good to do that, because then they understand why it's a good thing that they need to pay for. Because at the moment they're going to have to put the money out of their own pocket. And I also point out that it's non-invasive.
Yes.
If it's negative, we're going to be really happy that we don't need to do a colonoscopy. And I say, and isn't that good news? Because if you have a colonoscopy, you're going to have a couple of days off work.
Yep.
You're going to have to drink 3 litres of bowel prep. It's going to give you terrible diarrhoea. And then we're going to put a tube in your bowel, and there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that we might put a hole in it, and all for no good reason. Suddenly people are happy to pay, because they go, oh, I see. So I think it's about understanding.
Yes, because confidence in diagnosis is pretty crucial for IBS, isn't it? Otherwise, people get stuck in this cycle of testing and testing and testing, and doctors, you know, searching for a doctor who'll tell them what's going on.
Yeah, and they worry because if they don't get a diagnosis that the doctor's confident of, then they think, oh, doctor's not sure. They think they've missed something. Oh, I better go and see another doctor.
Yes.
And the more tests that get ordered, the more the patient is getting the signal that, oh, doctor's worried. They're looking again, or they're looking for something else. And, you know, that just sends all the wrong messaging. And you'd be worried too if, you know, every time you went to the doctor, they sent you for another test instead of being quite clear and direct about what's going on.
One of the things that intrigued me about your narrative review, and it was the first part. It's IBS is so prevalent that it can't possibly be dealt with in specialty settings.
No, it makes no sense. Yeah. I mean, from a business model point of view, from a common sense point of view, it's just a no-brainer.
Yeah. So primary care physicians, GPs, have to figure out how to be confident in their diagnosis of this.
Yes, and we need to help them by suggesting good strategies. And that was really the main point of this article because, look, I qualified as a gastroenterologist at the end of 1994, so I've been doing this for a while, and I find it really, I guess, disappointing that people, you know, they go through the system for years and then they wait months to see someone who tells them, you know, something that I feel as if, you know, their grandmother could have told them, and I repeat myself every Friday afternoon about three or four times.
Yes.
And people go away going, oh gosh, now I feel much better. Why didn't anyone tell me that before? And I think, oh, I don't know.
we're trying to
work out a way that we can really get this message out there confidently and, you know, encourage people to deal with this well before there's a lot of anxiety and before people get pent up, you know, problems in terms of, you know, worry and testing. We say that people have got a headache. Nobody has problems with thinking, oh, I've got a headache and I've had a CT scan and I don't have a brain tumour, so I've just got a headache.
Yep.
We seem culturally to not be able to accept that, though, when it's a gut ache. And that is surprising to me. And that's actually an analogy I use with patients all the time. We also except that people can just have a bad back, but you do a scan of their back or an MRI and it's not going to help you, and they've still got a bad back. They're not making it up.
So it's important to get them out of the diagnosis phase and into the management phase.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the management of IBS.
Yeah.
What are the pharmacological options?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that because I rarely use any pharmacological options and I think they should be the last thing we get to because otherwise what we're setting up is an unrealistic expectation paradigm, because if you start with drugs and then the drug doesn't work, what has the patient learnt from that experience that you've got nothing to offer, because your first thing that you've offered is not very effective. Most of the drugs that are used to treat IBS are not highly effective. The gain over placebo is small, but the placebo effect is actually quite reasonable for everything. So I think in terms of first do no harm and also to get the best therapeutic benefit, what we should do, and my approach, is to talk to the patient. And first appointment with someone with IBS, I often have 40 minutes to an hour because it's crucial to get all that communication right, and you can't do it quickly if you didn't listen to the patient. The next thing is actually a lot of people don't need any treatment. They just need to be comfortable that that's what it is and that there's nothing else missed and they don't need to worry.
Yes, and they can just go away and adjust their life accordingly, yes.
Exactly, and, you know, I talk to them about it's you and your gut just learning to get along together and treat each other nicely. And to a lot of people that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are not whingers and most people will self-manage quite successfully.
Yeah.
And I leave the door open that if that's not working, come back and see me and we can discuss other treatment strategies.
So what's the next step?
So then the next steps kind of on equal footing is either diet or psychology.
Yes.
Because they are the two strategies with the most effective outcomes. So they both get somewhere between 70 and 80% of people who report a noticeable and worthwhile improvement.
What kind of diet works best?
So the one with the best efficacy data is the low FODMAP diet.
Okay.
And that is a diet where things which are fermentable and, you know, incompletely or irregularly absorbed are minimised in the diet.
Yep.
To see if people get a response. And then if they do get a response, the idea is that they and the dietitian work together to find what is their threshold, because we do want them to reintroduce all foods that are possible to reintroduce, because yes. we don't want people on a restricted diet long term.
No, because that's not good either, is it?
It's not good for two different reasons, mm-hmm. because they might not have a nutritionally healthy diet.
Yep.
And also it encourages too much concentration on I have a problem.
Yes.
And that encourages hypervigilance, and that can be a problem.
Yeah.
Because if you are looking for symptoms, you will often find them.
Obviously, cognitive behavioural therapy would be the gold standard probably. But you also mentioned hypnotherapy.
They're often used in combination.
Okay.
So experienced psychologists, and particularly people who've got a bit of an interest in this brain-gut interaction, will often use a bit of a blended program where there is some CBT,
yes.
some hypnotherapy, and some relaxation therapy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tricks is finding the appropriate practitioners in your area.
Yes, because presumably you want them to have some kind of experience in the whole gut.
Yeah, or to have some interest in learning some.
Yes.
And, you know, part of the rationale for trying to get this sort of information out there is that, you know, who's going to bother doing a course on this for hypnotherapy if they're not getting any referrals? The people who've got hypervigilance and symptom monitoring and anxiety issues – they respond brilliantly to that combination of CBT and hypnotherapy.
Yes. What's the take-home message for GPs?
The take-home message is that IBS is common. We can recognise it on the positive features.
Yes.
And it is very easy with a structured clinical history and some very simple tests to rule out any other problems.
Thanks,
Jane. Thanks,
Jane. Cheers.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.